Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young is off today. Donor nations from around the world and international lending institutions like the World Bank have gathered in Amman, Jordan today for the start of a two-day conference on Iraq. Their purpose? To take stock of how much money has been sent to Iraq for reconstruction and how that money has been spent. Meanwhile, the Iraqi government says the death toll in one weekend attack alone has reached around 100 people. In that attack on Saturday, a suicide bomber blew himself up under a fuel tanker near a mosque in the town of Musayib. Borzu Daragahi is a correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and he joins us from Baghdad. Welcome, Borzu.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've traveled to the town of Musayib, where insurgents blew up a fuel tanker, and we want to talk about that. But first, an update, because there have been more attacks this morning. Tell us about those.
It seems to be the usual tit for tat, a bunch of police officers killed. You know, this has gotten rather ordinary at this point in the Iraqi capital. Iraqi police officers killed by insurgents, gunmen, and in retaliation, often some of these cops will go out and capture some people they suspect as insurgents, and, you know, their bodies show up a few days later.
Tell us a little bit about what you saw in Musayib yesterday.
Well, I unfortunately couldn't get right into the downtown Musayib, but it was a really ugly scene. There was a huge blackened circle in the middle of the downtown square. Many of the victims were taken to a hospital in nearby Hilla, which is the big provincial capital nearby. The types of injuries that were inflicted on the poor people in this village were absolutely horrifying. Lots of people with third-degree burns. Lots of just horrifying, ugly shrapnel wounds. These were just a group of innocent people having an evening stroll before heading home right around the time of evening prayers.
Borjo, help us sort some of this out, because U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Richard Myers says that, look, as bad as it is, Iraq is improving, things are getting better. The fact is the death toll is rising, the insurgent attacks are growing. They're growing more effective. Who has a better grasp on what's really happening here?
I will say that there's in terms of Iraqi sentiment on the street, as well as U.S. officials, there is a slight sense that as far as ordinary life is concerned, things are a little bit better. The ministries that collapsed after the fall of Saddam Hussein are up and running. There is a functioning police force that's out there at least trying to stop crime. The traffic situation in the capital has gotten a little bit better. People seem to be behaving a little better, a little bit more civil. But, you know, what's the sort of the dilemma is that none of that has affected the insurgency. None of that has changed the violent insurgency, and that continues to rage.
There is an international donors conference that begins today in Amman, the capital of Iraq's neighbor in Jordan. Now, this is the fourth conference since Saddam Hussein was toppled. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, many Iraqi officials say that if the U.S. would spend a quarter of what it spends on military operations, on reconstruction and getting jobs for young, aimless Iraqi men, they would accomplish a lot more in terms of stopping the insurgency. That's been a real challenge, spending money in Iraq. You know, even if a country wants to spend money in Iraq, you know, how are they going to do it? How are they going to work on a public works project and send their people from Canada or France or Germany in harm's way, knowing that they can be killed very easily or kidnapped? So many foreign contractors have been threatened and hounded out of the country. There's another issue. Some of the diplomats that I've spoken to say that, look, how do we give money to this government? We don't know who these people are. We don't trust them. They're really worried about corruption.
Borzu, while we have you, the Iraqi Special Tribunal that's in charge of the trial of Saddam Hussein is making progress. And in fact, they've said that they've completed their investigation. The trials are about to begin. And I would imagine that's a cause for some excitement in Iraq, isn't it?
I got to say that I think that the excitement in the West about this trial far exceeds the excitement here in Iraq. As a matter of fact, a lot of people and even U.S. officials here think that this trial right now is a pretty dangerous thing, given the fact that Saddam Hussein was a Sunni Arab, and the interim government and the U.S. officials are trying to bring Sunni Arabs into the political process. They think that bringing this trial up right now is very dangerous.
Borzu Daragahi is a Baghdad-based correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, thanks.
Thank you.
UCLA geography and physiology professor Jared Diamond took on no less than mapping the entire course of human history in his groundbreaking 1997 book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. His theory on why Europeans came to dominate the globe won him the Pulitzer Prize. And now it's become a three-part documentary series.
Whatever I work on for the rest of my life, I can never work on questions as fascinating as the questions of guns, germs, and steel, because they're the biggest questions of human history.
Programs now airing on PBS stations around the country. This comes as Diamond's sequel, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, marks 26 weeks on New York Times bestseller list. Here and now is Robin Young, recently spoke to Diamond about both books.
Professor Diamond, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And as those who read your book know, you worked extensively in Papua New Guinea before writing both books. Why Papua New Guinea?
No, because the island of New Guinea has 1,000 different tribes and languages, which is 1/6 of the world's total. It has a range of habitats from coral reefs and tropical rainforests up to glaciers. So climbing a mountain in New Guinea is like going from the equator up to the poles. And it has the largest group of people in the modern world who enter the modern world using stone tools and wooden tools rather than metal tools. So New Guinea is an extraordinary, fascinating, instructive place.
Papua New Guinea was the launch pad for your work, but one man in particular propelled it, a man named Yali. He asked you a question 30 years ago.
Yali asked me, why is it that you white people have so much cargo and we New Guineans have none or so little? Cargo is the New Guinea Neo-Melanesian word for material goods, and it's the most obvious thing about the differences between New Guineans and people from the first world. And despite its obviousness, I didn't know the answer to this most basic fact of the modern world and of history.
Well, you set out, as you say, to find out where this inequality comes from. But as you well know, a lot of people hearing this now, hearing that question for the first time, bubbling up to the surface might be, well, because we're smarter, that it's a genetic thing. So tell me, what did you think you were going to find out about why some cultures advanced, had more cargo, and others didn't?
What did I find? Well, as to what I didn't find, it's exemplified by what you just suggested, genetic factors, and it's exemplified by an email that I received from a gentleman who wrote me to say, Diamond, you're being too politically correct. I have traveled the world, the letter writer. And I know that the answer is that those people out there are just too stupid, and you can't teach them anything any more than you can teach domestic animals anything. When I started out in New Guinea in 1964, I was really naive, and I thought, okay, these are primitive people, and it took me about 12 hours to discover that although they had stone tools, there's nothing primitive about them mentally, and they're as smart and alert and curious as Japanese and Europeans and Americans. And for 15 years, I didn't have any idea until in the late 1980s, it began to dawn on me. This was all connected to the rise of complex societies with food surpluses that could feed inventors and kings and bureaucrats, so it all had to do with the rise of agriculture.
Let's take listeners through your thinking. You travel back in time to the Fertile Crescent, where farming was invented.
Well, yeah, we go back 5,000 years to the first state societies with writing, and that was in the Fertile Crescent of southwestern Asia, where the first states and writing systems and bronze and iron tools arose thousands of years before anywhere else. And so it's obvious that those who had writing and states and metal tools first were destined to spread over the world. Writing and metal tools depended upon farmers being able to feed specialists who wouldn't have to go out and hunt or produce their own food, but that requires agriculture. And agriculture rose only in a few parts of the world where there are lots of wild domesticable plants and animals, notably the Fertile Crescent with the wild ancestors of wheat and barley and sheep and goats and horses, and then in China with wild ancestors of rice and water buffalo.
Well, so now we come to a crucial point for potential conquerors in Europe. They have horses to ride. They have farm surpluses, so they've had time to develop weapons. And a crucial point is the development of swords. Let's listen here to that point in your story.
Swords like this, rapiers, represented a high point in a very sophisticated metalworking technology. It took centuries to get to the level of sophistication where you could get something so long and elegant and fine and deadly as the rapier.
A portion of the documentary that's been made of Jared Diamond's best-selling book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Professor Diamond, would that be the steel?
That would be the steel. In fact, in the documentary, there is a recreation of the Battle of Cajamarca in Peru in 1532, when 168 Spaniards with steel swords and armor faced an Inca army of 70,000 with mostly wooden and stone tools, and within 10 minutes, 7,000 Incas were killed and not a single Spaniard. And that was then followed up by about five more battles in which literally a few dozen Spanish horsemen were fighting thousands and thousands of Incas, and there was again mass slaughter. The reason is that a steel sword and steel armor are just far more potent killing weapons and defense than are a wooden club and cotton armor. So the development of metal was a big deal in world history, and the steps were that those first farmers of the Fertile Crescent, who developed farming about 8500 BC, developed the first metal weapons, namely copper swords, 5,000 BC, and then they developed bronze swords, 3,000 BC, and then finally they developed iron around 1,500, 1,000 BC.
You also talk extensively about the importance of germs. Obviously, it's in the title. And we know in America how disease can devastate a native people. But why weren't the Europeans as apt to catch diseases from the Native Americans? Why didn't it work the other way?
That's a really interesting question. Germs like smallpox and measles and TB and flu killed about 95% of Native Americans. It turns out that these crowd infectious diseases of humans, like smallpox and measles, came to us in the last 10,000 years from diseases of our domestic animals with which we came into close contact because we brought the little lambs and calves into our huts and drank their milk and breathed out air with their germs, so that people in Eurasia were infected by the germs of domestic animals, which then evolved into smallpox and measles, etc.
We're talking to award-winning author Jared Diamond, whose premise that guns, germs, and steel, and geography, and domesticated animals, and the ability to farm, that's what shaped successful cultures. And Europeans, as you point out, were only able to gain control of Africa, for instance, because of their dominance of steel and the development of the first automatic weapon in the late 1800s.
Most of the leading technological innovations that we associate with Western Europe all came from outside Europe. They came from China. They came from the Middle East. There was no major technological innovation that we can credit to, particularly northwestern Europe, until water-driven mills around AD 1000. One can also lay out not only where the guns came from, but where did European writing come from? It came from the Fertile Crescent. Where did European copper, bronze, and iron techniques come from? From the Fertile Crescent in Turkey. Where were the first empires? They were in the Fertile Crescent. Everything interesting was imported into Europe until Europe started taking off in the Middle Ages.
That's award-winning author Jared Diamond. When we come back, we'll hear the rest of Robin's conversation with Diamond as they discuss the rise and fall of human civilizations in his new book, Collapse. There's more ahead, here and now. Today, we've been hearing from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jared Diamond. His latest book, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, questions whether we are doomed to repeat the mistakes of past empires. Here and Now's Robin Young spoke to Professor Diamond recently and asked him what lessons we can draw from the decline of the Fertile Crescent, believed to be the birthplace of modern civilizations.
The Fertile Crescent, in effect, committed ecological suicide, not intentionally, but inadvertently, because it's a low rainfall environment subject to deforestation and soil erosion and salinization. And that's why the Fertile Crescent lost its enormous head start to the ecologically more robust European peninsula.
Now, you identify five major causes of societal collapse: environmental damage, climate change, hostile neighbors, loss of trade partners, and plain stupidity, which we seem to have in abundance. Let's pick one of the peoples that you pick in the book, the case of the Norse in Greenland. What led to their downfall?
In Greenland, the Norse did not have guns, germs, and steel because of the distance from Europe. They were fighting it out with the Inuit on a basis of equality with the same bows and arrows and spears that the Inuit had. And by about 1440, every Norseman and Norsewoman was dead, and the Inuit took over Greenland, and they've been there ever since. That's as close as you can get to a controlled experiment to see whether Europeans have any intrinsic superiority.
Another area you focus on, Easter Island, a society that lived and died in almost complete isolation. It's so fascinating because of some of the relics that are left. What lessons can we draw from Easter Island, in your opinion?
Easter Island in the year 1680 is a metaphor for a worst-case scenario of the world today. Easter Island is an isolated island in the Pacific Ocean, 2,300 miles off the coast of Chile. Its inhabitants, Polynesians, are famous for the gigantic stone statues weighing up to 80 tons that they erected without any metal tools or wheels, quite an achievement. And they chop down trees like everybody else, but Easter Island is a dry, cool place where if you chop down trees, the trees don't grow back fast enough to replace the ones you've chopped down. So around 1680, the Easter Islanders have chopped down the last tree, which meant that they've run out of wood to make canoes, to go out to sea to harpoon fish. They also ran out of wood to erect their statues. And Easter Island society collapsed in an epidemic of cannibalism. Everybody sees that this is a metaphor for the planet Earth today. If we get into severe trouble by messing up our own world, the way the Easter Island has messed up Easter Island, there isn't going to be any galaxy that we can flee to either, and there aren't going to be any nice green extraterrestrials who come help us out, just as with Easter Islanders.
But as you know, there are some people who say there may be galaxies that we flee to. And unlike Easter Island, societies aren't isolated. And that's been a criticism of your fear that the world may be near a crisis point now, that we're in a different time and that the world seems to rally just at the point when it's needed in times of crisis.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if that were true? Greg Easterbrook, in his New York Times review of my book, complained that I had a short-term view. I was worried about the next 50 or 100 years, when 10,000 years from now we'll be colonizing other galaxies. Well, I would say to Greg Easterbrook and his children, that's very comforting that 10,000 years from now, if you have any descendants, they'll be on other galaxies. I'm concerned about, and everybody else except you on Earth is concerned about, what's going to happen to us and our children in the next 50 years.
Well, there's so much else that you write that you're concerned about, including global population. But despite everything you write in your books, you describe yourself as cautiously optimistic. And I'm wondering, how can that be? Because after I read them, I think they're cause for alarm.
I'm cautiously optimistic because of you. And I mean that. You meaning the media today, because of global communication. The whole world today has the ability to find out what's happening in other parts of the world. And also, here we are talking about archaeology and societies 8,000 years ago. We can learn about societies of the past. But the Easter Islanders, when they chopped down the last tree in 1680 on their island, they had no way of knowing about the successful reforestation going on in Japan in 1680, nor did the Easter Islanders know that the Maya had messed up by chopping down their trees around the year 800. So what makes me cautiously optimistic is that we're the first society today in world history with the potential for learning from societies remote from us in space and remote from us in time.
It's funny, you know, we started, Professor, by learning about how you started in Papua New Guinea, answering a question that a man asked you, why is it that Westerners have more cargo, more things, more weapons than he did? That sent you on your exploration of why some cultures got guns and steel and things like that, while Papua New Guinea remains, backward, if you will. But I'm wondering, then, as I read the pages of your second book, Collapse, as these huge cultures collapsed, the ones who had a lot of cargo, I'm wondering if you think in the end the fellow in Papua New Guinea might be more likely to survive.
That's up for grabs, and that depends entirely on the decisions that we make. It's not inevitable that modern society will collapse or even go downhill. It is the case that Americans today, the mass of Americans, are more concerned than at any time in my lifetime about where the world is going and what is happening to the United States today. And the United States faces more difficult problems today, even though we are the world's richest country. The dangers to us are things that we are doing ourselves.
Jared Diamond, a UCLA geography and physiology professor, author of the best-selling Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies, and its sequel, Collapse, how societies choose to fail or succeed. And Professor, what's next now that you've done the rise and fall of world history?
I'm just starting to work on a new book, which is going to take me another 7 years to finish. So that's what's next.
Any hint?
There'll be something about New Guinea in the new book, and I think that's as much as I can safely say at the moment.
Well, Professor Diamond, I can't wait to hear about it. Thanks so much.
You are welcome. Glad to talk with you.
Jared Diamond is a professor of geography and physiology at UCLA. He spoke to Here and Now's Robin Young. To see photos from Diamond's new documentary, Guns, Germs, and Steel, you can visit our website, here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the U.S. in Iraq. We talk to a defense analyst who says the U.S. can't stay and it can't go. And he's proposing a third scenario. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Robin Young is on vacation. The investigation is heating up into the Bush administration's role in exposing CIA agent Valerie Plame. Earlier today, President Bush again told reporters he'll fire anyone who committed a crime in the affair. But he said it's too soon to say his senior advisor, Karl Rove, should go.
And I think it's best that people wait until the investigation is complete before you jump to conclusions, and I will do so as well. I don't know all the facts. I want to know all the facts. The best place for the facts to be done is by somebody who's spending time investigating it. I would like this to end as quickly as possible so we know the facts.
Well, outside the grand jury room, the plot thickened today with reporter Matt Cooper's article in Time magazine. Cooper said unequivocally that Rove was the first one to tell him that former Ambassador Joseph Wilson's wife worked for what Rove called the agency, and that Wilson's wife was responsible for sending Wilson on a mission to find a connection to the nation of Niger and possible weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The agency he referred to is the CIA, and knowingly outing a covert CIA agent is a felony. Also today, another of Cooper's sources was revealed as well, Louis Libby, who is Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff. Cooper, unlike New York Times reporter Judith Miller, avoided a prison sentence when Time magazine turned over his notes and emails to federal authorities and by testifying before a federal grand jury investigating the leak of Valerie Plame's name. Time magazine's political reporter Joe Klein joins us on the line to sort out some of the latest developments and talk about his column in today's Time magazine. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, Frank. Good to be here.
Hey, let's talk about some of the latest developments in the story. Louis Libby's name is now part of this. Does that change the significance of the story?
No. I mean, Libby's name was out there in the past. You know, Cooper had been given a waiver by Libby about a year ago, and he had testified to the grand jury a year ago that Libby hadn't given him the name of Valerie Plame. And that's a very interesting part of this. Continually, journalists who've been called in have been asked whether they gave Valerie Plame's name to administration officials, which, you know, leads to the speculation that that may be what this whole inquiry is about, whether a journalist is the target of the inquiry rather than the administration leakers.
Well, Joe, that leads us to this. The president just concluded a news conference this morning, and I think we were probably on the phone to you when he was asked the question about this investigation. But we were watching, and I'll summarize his answer. He said, look, there's an ongoing investigation. We shouldn't try this in the press. There's a prosecutor handling this, and he, the president, is going to wait until that prosecutor comes up with his conclusion. And I'm wondering, as Karl Rove's boss, why George Bush can't find out today.
I think that the question here in the president's mind is whether or not Rove will be indicted for perjury or something like that. If Rove comes out clean, I mean, there hasn't been a judgment cast upon him yet, then technically the president doesn't have to take action. However, he did pretty much indicate in the past that, you know, he was going to fire anybody who had leaked this stuff to the press.
And that is something, as I say, that the president really can find out, can't he?
Oh, yeah. Well, he could have found that out 2 years ago. The question is whether he asked Rove and Rove said, no, it wasn't me.
Well, certainly initially they were talking all about it, and they said, it's ridiculous. This is not, we weren't any part of this. Now they're saying, the administration anyway, that we can't talk about this. Any idea?
The law is a convenient shield at times, isn't it, Frank?
Well, how is it playing out in the public? Is the story being lost in the welter of legal detail that's now sort of unfolding as the story unfolds? Or well, do you think, voters are kind of focused on the two key points?
Well, I don't think voters are focused on this at all. I don't think that this is a major issue with the public in any way, shape, or form, which is why the Bush administration kind of thinks it can get away with fudging it. And in my column this week, you know, what I point out is that the real issue here, the most important thing, aside from leaking the name of a covert agent if Valerie Plame was indeed still undercover, the most important thing here is that this is an illumination of the way that the Bush administration has dealt with Iraq from the beginning. They've dealt with the bad news from Iraq as if it were a political issue, not an issue of life and death, not an issue of war and peace. The reason why the folks from the administration were knocking down this story were political. They had nothing to do with national security. And if you remember the bottom line of the story, it's this: that there was no yellow cake uranium deal between Iraq and the country of Niger, which is essentially what Wilson said in his report. Now, there's a lot of fudging and obfuscation going on, but the reason why the administration was so intent on knocking down that story was because they were in the middle of a reelection campaign, and the story led to the obvious conclusion that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and that the administration had gone into overdrive to try and divert attention from that. I think that that's a recurring pattern. It's a pattern that still exists. Right now we have a very, very serious situation in Iraq, and the vice president says that the insurgency is in its last throes, and the president still spinning as he did during the campaign. He got on the air in late June, and the speech was a compendium of the same old platitudes.
However the public is perceiving this, there, in terms of credibility, there's also a problem when you're prosecuting that war in Iraq, that a war in which intelligence is vital. You know, what's the impact on that effort when it seems that the administration is willing to give up intelligence sources for political reasons?
Well, I think that that's absolutely right. And in this case, you're dealing with an agent who, at one point in her career, and maybe in a continuing way, I mean, you know, we don't know the ways of undercover spies, but she was involved in weapons of mass destruction research. She gave her address as a front company in Boston, which was called Brewster Jennings. By exposing her, that, you know, that front company also was exposed. Now, we don't know what she was doing. It's one of the great unknowns in this case. She may have, after she had kids, gone back to just being an analyst in the area of weapons of mass destruction at CIA. But the fact is, she was operating at various points in her career under non-official cover, which is the deepest sort of secret spy work that agents of the United States government do.
I mean, that's when you can be out there on your own, disavowed, and nobody remembers you.
Most of our spooks operate under official cover when they're in embassies overseas, you know, like they're the agricultural attaché or the information officer or whatever, but really working for the CIA. The next level down in secrecy are people who don't travel with a diplomatic passport, who travel under the cover of being business people or whatever, and she was one of those, which is why the people I know in the intelligence community were so outraged when they found out that she had been a non-official cover.
Joe, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Joe Klein is a political reporter with Time magazine. He writes this week about the political ramifications of the Karl Rove-Valerie Plame affair. Still to come, life on the quadriplegic rugby circuit. We'll look at a documentary film called Murder Ball. You're listening to Here and Now. On AOL Sports Bloggers Live podcast, he's called Alex the Phenom. On his own online blog, he offers controversial opinions on everything from steroids in baseball, he believes the performance-enhancing drugs saved the game, to what he calls bandwagon baseball fans, casual fans who take seats from the real fans. He's Alex Reamer, and he is only 12 years old, and he is from Natick, Massachusetts, and recently spoke with Robin Young from his family vacation in California.
Tell us about some of your strong opinions. For instance, what's this about steroids saving baseball?
Well, you know that the strike happened in the early 90s, mm-hmm. and after that, you know, after most strikes, attendance was way down, and baseball needed something to save themselves. So basically what happened was you had the home run chase with Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, and, you know, I mean, they were huge, and it's now been suspected that both of them did use performance-enhancing drugs. And we also know that performance-enhancing drugs helped home run numbers skyrocket, so to speak. And the home runs brought the fans back to the ballparks, so nobody really did anything about it.
Well, that's one of your opinions. You also say that Dick Vitale, the sports announcer, is an idiot. On your blog, you write, I've said it for a while, but his comments on international players getting drafted ahead of American players for the NBA is absurd. I've said for a while now that Vitale is a moron, and that comment proved it. Alex, are you at all concerned about how strong your opinions are?
Well, I feel that to be successful, don't you need strong opinions?
Well, that would seem to be. I understand you tried to call local sports radio stations to offer opinions on the air. What happened?
Well, basically, they have a strict policy where you can't call in when you're under 18 years of age. And, you know, I respect that, and I've tried a couple of times, but they wouldn't let me on.
Did you try to disguise your voice at all?
Yep.
What'd you do?
I talked in kind of a lower voice, since my voice obviously is kind of high.
Let me hear you trying to be 18. I'm just curious.
Hey. You know, I would, yeah. It's kind of hard to do, though, because,
right.
You know, then your voice
right.
breaks and they find out.
I want to get to some of your other opinions. I've been on your blog quite a bit. And, for instance, bandwagon fans, they drive you crazy. You say true fans can't get into Fenway Park here in Boston because stupid bandwagon fans bring their bimbo girlfriends and leave by the fifth inning.
Well, basically, I didn't mean it in that context. I just basically said that, like, Yankee Stadium was the place to be in the late 90s and early millennium. Fenway Park is now basically the place to be. Like, the Staples Center in Los Angeles was the place to be for celebrities to be seen, and now it's Fenway. I mean, they pay for tickets, they buy the stuff, so gives the Red Sox money. But, you know, to some people, if you want to go to a playoff game, you can't go because, you know, it's kind of frustrating, but, you know, it's all right.
Yeah. Who do you think's going to win the World Series this year?
I think the St. Louis Cardinals, because they have a huge offense. The middle of the lineup features Albert Pujols, Jim Edmonds, Scott Rowland. They have a leadoff man in David Eckstein who has made contact in every at-bat this year except seven of them. Their rotation is actually pretty good. They got Chris Carpenter, who started the game for the National League All-Stars, Mark Mulder and Matt Morris as their top 1-2-3. And their bullpen is a very good bullpen as well. They can close down games. So I think in a short series, the Cardinals are the most dangerous team.
And by the way, Alex, before we let you go, some people will say, why should I listen to a 12-year-old kid? What does he know? What would you say about that?
Well, basically, I just think that, you know, I respect their opinion. And if they don't want to listen to me, that's fine. But, you know, I feel that I know just as much as adults. And, you know, I think that maybe some of the sports media or anything in life should stop maybe being like a sports club or like a country club and accept new members.
And you are one of them.
Yep.
Alex Reamer, sports blogger, 12 years old. He's called Alex the Phenom on Sports Bloggers Live podcast, and he's got his own online blog. Speaking to us, taking a break from his family vacation. Alex, thanks a lot.
No problem.
Alex Reamer spoke with Here and Now's Robin Young. For more information, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. critics are raving about the fast-paced, in-your-face documentary Murderball, and rap artist Eminem recently expressed interest in starring in a fictionalized version of the story. Murderball tells a tale of athletes with a lot of attitude and a lot of heart who play quadriplegic rugby.
What we do is we take these wheelchairs and make them into a gladiator, a battling machine, a Mad Max wheelchair that can withstand knocking the living daylights out of each other.
The majority of the people that play wheelchair rugby have broken their necks. So we have rods, plates, screws inside. The biggest misconception is, you're quadriplegic? Oh, I thought they couldn't move their arms. And I'm like, no, I have impairment in all four limbs.
That's Mark Zupan, one of the stars of the new documentary Murderball. Recently, Mark and co-director Dana Adam Shapiro came by our studios to chat with Here and Now host Robin Young.
Everybody get back! Get the hell back!
Okay, so I watched this gripping film, which had my heart going from the first second. I was trying to think, how would I describe this? And I was coming up with phrases like punk quadriplegics, quadriplegics with attitude. How would you describe the guys that you played rugby with?
Pretty much normal, but twisted in a way. I mean, we're normal guys, but we like to watch Jackass. We like
the TV show.
Yeah. We like good music, good food. We like to dress pretty hip. And a wheelchair is not going to change you. It's just going to expand your horizon and show you that there's that much more to do and that much more fun to have. Your life isn't over because you're in a wheelchair. And being exposed to wheelchair rugby has been godsend. I've been exposed to different people, different lifestyles, different challenges, avenues, places to go. I mean,
yeah. Well, but Dana, as I said, there's an attitude in this film. It is starkly different. I mean, what Mark just said so eloquently, we've heard that before, but there's something in this film that we haven't heard or seen before. Can you? What do you think it is?
I think a lot of times movies about the unfortunate, be they cripples or any type of, you know, quote-unquote victim, tends to be a little bit heavy on the sentiment, a lot of cueing of the violins and pulling the heartstrings and that attitude, that sort of good for you, it's so
woe
good to see
me,
you out,
cripple woe movie.
Is me, that type of stuff. Well, it seems, and I know it does come from a good place, tends to be a little condescending in its treatment of the guys. I mean, we treated them just like regular people. The chair was definitely a huge part of their identity, but we weren't impressed by them just because they could open a door or there wasn't
brush
something
teeth.
That, yeah, we tried to let the material speak for itself and really remove our point of view.
He has always been what I call a tough kid. You know, I know very few people that would ever with Mark.
Just to see him out on the court with the tattoos up his arm and the goatee, he's intimidating. He's one of these players that people try to just stay away from.
Well, Mark, help us understand wheelchair rugby, because, as I said, that's the thread that goes through the film, and then it goes off into all of these other directions. But how is the game played? I understand there's a point system, first of all.
Right. You're given a point value depending upon your level of disability or how much function you have. It starts at 0.5, goes to 3.5. You have 8 points on the court at one time. So it's in increments of 0.5, so you can put 3 5, 2 2s, and a 0.5 on the court. Right. So it keeps it kind of even.
Right. So in other words, if somebody has only a certain amount of use of their hands, let's say, mm-hmm. they get a certain point for that. If somebody has more use of their hands, as you do, you get a different kind of point, and it has to get averaged out.
Right. They test your hands. They test tricep, bicep, just every muscle that you would use to participate.
And describe these Mad Max-like wheelchairs that you're in. I mean, it's just astonishing. You're looking to knock the other guy over.
Of course.
The other guys stop you by slamming their chair into you.
Help him! Dave! Dave! Help him!
You have to dribble the ball or pass to a teammate once every 10 seconds. But other than that, it's basically kill the man with the ball.
The chair is kind of like a mini tank. You look at it and it's reinforced so much more than a regular chair. There's wings. The wheels are cambered out, so they're angled out so it turns quicker. The front end is, it looks like something on a train, a cow catcher.
Right, right.
And you use that to deliver the hits. And
it's just astonishing, the athleticism and also the bumper car nature of it. Dana, did you know about these sort of quadriplegic gladiators? I mean, when did you hear about it?
I heard about it in the spring of 2002, and I read this article online. It was all about these quadriplegics who play this crazy sport, and I'd thought that all quadriplegics were like Christopher Reeve, that they couldn't move at all, let alone play a full contact Paralympic sport, and in the article it got into sex and it got into their jobs and driving, and there was comedy in the article. They were sort of ribbing each other. Of course, underneath all of this were these incredible tragedies.
And Mark, in your case, this friend that was driving drunk the night that you got thrown out of the back of his pickup, you played soccer together. There's pictures in the film of how glorious a soccer player you were.
I was a fairly decent player. Chris and I went to high school together. We were roommates in college. He didn't play soccer, but it was my best friend.
And this, as the story unfolds, and I don't want to tell too much of it because I want people to see it, and there's a lot revealed at the end, but how did your relationship suffer and then somewhat get repaired after the accident?
I forgave him the instant he came into the hospital. Not his fault. It was an accident. I mean, you can't be bitter towards somebody who made an accident, a similar accident that you probably would have made.
Because you were drunk in the back
of the
pickup.
Right, I passed out in the back of the pickup truck. Yeah. So our relationship's been up and down since, you know, that day.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, we probably both ended up getting disabled in a way. I did physically, he did maybe mentally. Because you see your best friend, you see him in a chair, and you're like, oh, wait, you know, I did this to him. Mm. Which has kind of turned into a big joke. It's like, hey, Igo, you're the quad father.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious if you ask me.
Well, you know, and I'm wondering too, how...
I mean, it's fun. If you can't laugh at a situation, then you can't live.
Right.
I mean, it's humbling, of course, but if I can't laugh every day and say, oh yeah, that was kind of humorous and it may have been stupid and you have to do it.
First time I saw Martin Zupan was at a friend of ours' funeral. He rolled in, introduced himself, and I don't think we had a moment apart from that night.
Mark Zupan, here you are. You've reached the pinnacle in a sport. You're a superb athlete. Anybody who sees this film is going to be just blown away by it. You're the star of a film. You're passing on what you've learned to other people. You know, people always wonder, how would I feel? What would it be like if this happened to me?
Right.
Is the old life, do you lay awake at night wishing you could play something? No.
No regrets. You live in the moment. You don't live in the past. And you figure that out. It's like, oh, you know, I can't walk. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Because?
Would you and I be sitting here talking today? Yeah. Would I have been afforded the opportunity to go to the Paralympics? No. Would I have been to New Zealand 3 times? Probably not. Would I have met the people and done the things that I have done? No. Don't let the chair keep you from doing what you want to do. You can do anything you want.
Mark Zupan, one of the stars of Murderball, speaking to Here and Now's Robin Young. Robin also spoke with the film's co-director, Dana Adams Shapiro. For more information on the documentary, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Frank Stacio. Join us again, Here and Now.
Or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Frank Stanley.